This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. If 2020 was dominated by talk of global recession, the 2021 narrative has been one of global economic recovery. But it's not without its twists and turns as the Delta variant emerged as the surprise villain stalling reopenings. And as we enter into the final quarter of the year, the world's economic engine, China, is facing multiple challenges, from a property debt crisis to energy shortages that could threaten its recovery. For a prognosis of the global and Chinese economy, joining me on the show is Andy Xie, an independent economist based in Shanghai. Good morning, Andy. Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill.
Good morning.
Now, the last time we spoke to you was in March 2020, before the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. Back then, you predicted that a global recession was likely, given the impact of physical lockdowns on economic activity, especially the services sector. And indeed, this did happen, with the global economy shrinking by 4.3% thereabouts. Now, if we flash forward 16 months later, the world economy seems to be on the mend, with growth projected at over 5% and marking the fastest post-recession recovery in 80 years, according to the World Bank. Is this vindication of the massive quantitative easing and stimulus measures that governments around the world took in response to the pandemic?
Well, I think that not necessarily. The global economy is recovering because vaccination is happening. The vaccines are making it possible for people to get reconnected. So in the developed economies, 70%, over 70% is service based. So it's having a big impact. You know, if without the vaccines, we still be stuck. So I think that the stimulus itself couldn't have done that. On the other side is that the stimulus is kind of was done over the top. You look at the U.S. Fiscal deficit, it was $3 trillion, about 15% of GDP. And this year is another $3 trillion. And we see to a lesser degree in Europe and in Japan. What we are seeing now is a bit overheating, because basically the governments were giving free money to people, or helicopter money to people, to sit at home. And now with the vaccines having an impact, there's a lot of spending. So this is where you see that inflation pressure is very high. And the central banks are still not taking back the stimulus. And the government's not taking back the stimulus. They're worried that we could go back to recession. Because this hesitancy is pushing the global economy towards this path of overheating and inflation. It's a very high risk.
So you are in the camp that this inflation isn't transitory. It's not just due to the one-off effects of the pandemic. Do you think it's here to stay then?
Yeah, I think that there was some structural reason why the world was becoming more inflation-prone. I was talking about China keeping inflation low for the world for a long time, because Chinese people got paid low wages and they were working very productive, like Europeans and Americans. So there was this arbitrage opportunity pulling down prices all over the world. In the last few years, we have seen labor shortage in China. And that is, even though the government is trying to keep the cost down, it's becoming more and more difficult. So China, instead of holding down the prices, it's possible that China would have to raise the prices. So there was a structural reason for that. On top of that, that basically the big central banks and the governments have been pouring oil on fire. And with this so much money, you look at the Federal Reserve, quantitative easing increased by $4 trillion. So basically, the Federal Reserve Bank's balance doubled. That kind of a stimulus and a monetary excess, plus inflation-prone global economy. So we could be in trouble. And you look at the energy prices, these are early signs.
Okay, let's bring oil prices into the picture, because you did mention this in our last conversation. You said that oil would be the indicator to watch in terms of heralding a global recession, and global oil prices indeed fell to historic lows in April last year. But prices have since rebounded, as you yourself pointed out, and they're trading now at multi-year highs, even though international travel hasn't recovered anywhere near pre-pandemic levels. What exactly explains this situation?
Well, I think this time the key driver is coal, the old-fashioned coal, people being talking down about it for so many years. As major governments and central banks are giving out helicopter money to people, they were basically pressing these apps on mobile phones for stuff. And this is what Western democracy is all about. It's about giving people a good time. So how to have a good time is to get free money from the government and use a mobile phone press and something comes, okay? So all these orders are coming to China. So Chinese exports are surging on a very high base. This year is rising at a pace of $700 billion to the level of $3.5 trillion. That's more than Japan's total export. So China is adding one Japan in a year. It's because of all these stimulus. Obviously, that increased a lot of energy demand. In China, it's coal, 70%. And nobody expects that. So we have a coal shortage. So this is why Chinese coal imports are rising at close to 30%. That is still not enough. So driving coal prices tripled. So these coal prices are leading and are pulling up the prices of other energy sources like oil and gas.
Okay. I want to come back to the question of stimulus, which you said has led to overheating of the global economy as it recovers from the pandemic. I'm just wondering if there was anything that could have been done differently, because for a while, as economies were shut down, people were saying that the government needed to spend in order to keep economies afloat and to keep people surviving. Could that have been done differently?
Yeah, you look at it with Germany, they pay the companies to keep people employed, even though they didn't have enough to do. Employment protection would be a better option instead of handing out so much money. Like lots of people in the United States were getting more money from handouts than from actual job without the pandemic. They should have kept the people in jobs so that with the recovery, the economy could go back to normal. Now you look at many countries, particularly in the United States, people don't want to work. You cannot find the people to work because a lot of people are getting used to free money and buying stuff on mobile phone. Then go on to watch Netflix, binge watching Netflix. So that is what we are seeing kind of world now. And they want to vote for that kind of life.
Okay, I'm not sure I entirely agree with you, Andy. I think there are some generalizations there, but I get the kind of trends that you're pointing out to. And it's true that there is a labor shortage that's being seen, as particularly in the U.S. How painful will the tapering be then? Is it inevitable that a taper tantrum will occur when the central banks first start quantitative easing, and then secondly, when they decide to hike interest rates?
Yeah, I think that the tapering is going to trigger a major downturn in the U.S. stock market. There are two big asset bubbles in the world, the Chinese property market and the U.S. Stock market. The U.S. stock market is trading at 2x GDP. It's just a crazy number. And historically, it was always under one. Now it's 2x, and people think that that's normal. Actually, it's 2x because of the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing. It's just you have more money, then their stock price can go higher. If they do tapering, shrinking the Federal Reserve's balance, the stock market will for sure go down big time because people are spending imaginary money in addition to the money from the government. Their stock portfolio is becoming higher. All these kind of Reddit guys punting in the market, driving up junk stocks to a really high price, like Tesla and all. So this is the volatile world we are in. I mentioned about the imbalance between the East and the West. Then there's also this imbalance due to this the asset market and the real income. The people are spending the money they don't have. It's imaginary.
Okay. Given that inflation is rising, how concerned are you about the risk of stagflation, where we see slow economic growth but also high inflation? And do you see some economies at greater risk than others for this scenario?
Yeah, I think the issue is that people, from the political perspective, politicians cannot tell people to suffer a little bit. You know, politicians always say it's going to be bad for you. If not, if you cannot do it, I'll help you. So the issue is that when inflation comes, the right thing to do is to hike the interest rate, like Paul Volcker did in the early 80s, and to do whatever it takes to keep a price stable. But now the government debt is so high. If you increase interest rate to a high level, the government would go bust. Like the U.S. government now has over 100% GDP in debt, and the deficit is like 15% of GDP. And with Biden's extra spending, they're talking about $3.5 trillion. So the central bank will be terrified that of the impact on the government finances. And also, when the stock market goes down, it becomes a political thing. So this is where that I see the central bank's hands are more tied than before.
Mm.
If they cannot respond, by the way, the big central banks like the Fed and ECB are run by lawyers. And I'm sure they are much more political than economists who were running these institutions before. So we see a mix of factors that could push the world towards stagflation.
When do you think major central banks will finally put the brakes on rising inflation by hiking interest rates?
Usually, you needed to change the leaders. I think that leopard cannot change its spots. You know, this is I think that the major change in policy is driven by personal change, and without Paul Volcker being installed, the U.S. would not have done what was needed to keep inflation down in the early 80s. That led to this subsequent productivity gain and economic growth, and basically the economy benefited from that for a long, long time. So I think that the people in charge now, you listen to what they are talking about, they run central banks like as if they are charities. Right, you know, they have these programs for helping SMEs, and they're talking about all the people who cannot pay rents. It's not their job.
Okay.
So this is the issue: is that the wrong people are in charge of these big central banks. So if as long as they are there, I think the world is in a lot of danger.
Okay. Interesting perspective there, Andy. I'm speaking to Andy Xie, an independent economist based in Shanghai. When we come back, can China continue its exponential growth? Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
You're tuned into the Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. Today, I'm speaking to independent economist Andy Xie, who specializes in China and Asia. Earlier, we discussed the recovery of the global economy from the COVID-19 pandemic. Let us turn our attention to China, because China's economy is still set to grow this year, but there are various headwinds eating into projections, most notably the property debt crisis exemplified by the Evergrande saga. So you yourself have long noted the dangers of China's property market, and the government appeared to heed those dangers when it introduced the Three Red Lines policy last year that put limits to borrowing by property developers. So is the Evergrande fallout now pretty much inevitable given the uncontrolled property expansion of the past 18 years?
Yeah, I think the Evergrande sticks out as a bad apple. It's basically a debt Ponzi scheme. And that also shows the complexity of Chinese politics, why a company like Evergrande could exist. So I think the government finally got around to that for many reasons. Some we will never know. They decided to pull the plug on this guy. Let's focus on this one incident, that is Evergrande, $300 billion, about 2 trillion RMB. Out of China's, according to the central bank, China's total credit is close to 300 trillion, of which probably half is property related. So this is big, but this is a small chunk of that. The second point is that the Chinese government will never allow bankruptcy to snowball like in the United States. Snowballing means that one guy goes bankrupt, then the creditors see the assets, liquidated assets, driving down the asset prices, and then other guys go bust, and then you have a snowballing. In China, the government will stop that because nobody can seize assets without government approval. Nobody can liquidate it without a government approval. So this kind of imagination of China getting to this financial crisis like in the United States is not going to happen. But that doesn't mean the problem doesn't exist. And we're talking about this huge property bubble, the residential property under construction, 6 billion square meters. That can house 300 million people. If you go to villages today in China, you only see mostly old people. They will never move. And you see some so-called left behind children. Not a whole lot. China's urbanization is pretty much done. So how are they going to sell this stuff? The financial guys can create this illusion. You pump money into the land market, the price goes up, then the collateral is worth more. You can borrow more money, then you pump money into that. You can keep it going, yeah? You can keep it going for a long, long time. The government finally decided really to stop this. I think this is the end. The issue is that how to get off this tiger.
I just want to come back to something that you said earlier, Andy, which is that China would never allow a bankruptcy to snowball. And I wonder if that's not the reason why property expansion has exploded so much over the past, two decades, because people are so certain that the government will bail them out. Doesn't that still create a cyclical problem?
Yeah, I think that firstly, this property bubble has existed for so long because the government liked it. The government was getting like 10% of GDP, in theory, free money from the property market. Like last year, the land sales were 8% of GDP. And because all the land is owned by the government in China, so it went into the government. And then other taxes, like land appreciation tax, transaction tax, stamp duty, another 2% of GDP. So we're talking about 10% of GDP, half of the money for most local governments. So there was this the political force behind this. But this, in a way, is self-deception because you have property developers who that borrow money to buy land from you, give you money, and you think that it's your fiscal revenue, but it's the other guy's debt. Now, I think that the political, the highest level, they think this is can bring down the system. Okay. In China, it's everything about is about preserving the party. That's why I think this is it, despite a tremendous local resistance. And the central government has made a decision.
I'm going to draw this to other regulatory tightening that we're seeing. I mean, we've seen the Chinese Communist Party tighten regulation on various economic sectors. Last year, it was property. But this year, we've seen crackdowns on tech, on education, on gaming. I'm wondering why the decision for back-to-back crackdowns is taken now. Wouldn't these changes hurt more at a time when the economy is vulnerable to pandemic shocks? Or is the government factoring this short-term pain for long-term gain under the common prosperity agenda?
Well, first is the government now is confident about China as the factory of the world. Apparently, the trade war has not dented that. With exports surging, the economy is on solid footing this year and possibly next year. And so there's room to do some other stuff that might not be good for growth. It's like speculative stuff or the technology stuff. When it comes to technology, people think that internet companies are tech companies. They're actually not. They use internet for commerce. These internet companies are headed not by tech people. They are headed by marketing people. The Chinese government was confused for a long time. So after the U.S. government targeted Huawei and other equipment-related companies, I think everybody in China realized that the internet companies were not important. They bring you a little bit more convenience. But life goes on. If you have to go out and buy stuff for yourself rather than somebody delivering to your home, doesn't make a difference to the country, doesn't make a difference to the economy. So their existence is not essential. The second thing is that political aspect. Internet companies can reach the population quickly. They can send a message quickly. And that is competing against the Communist Party. Historically, only the government can reach all the people quickly. Now, private companies can do that. So this is why the government is really worried about who are making decisions in these companies in terms of what they do, what they say. I think that the process is still ongoing. The government doesn't know where it's going to land, what such companies should become to to make the party feel secure. So I think that it's going to be quite a while. And the education part is also really important for the party, because you look at Hong Kong, what happened in Hong Kong is that 20 years of education not supervised by the central government, they nurtured a generation who were against the party. So from the party's perspective, you cannot let somebody educate the kids that who will rise up against you. So this is why I think that the private capital participation in education is over. You cannot do that.
This grand restructuring of the economy to sort of become more aligned with the CCP, is there any chance of this backfiring on President Xi Jinping? Because as you say, it will take time for results to manifest, for an end game to be reached. But in the meantime, could this just all go sour?
Well, I think no. I think that the issue is that there's this background of the U.S.-China rivalry. This is really getting nationalism going. I think that when the government tells Chinese people that the U.S. wants to bring down China, I think people can take a lot. And the Chinese people can take far more than what Americans can ever possibly accept. It's hard to understand. You look at the United States policy, it's just totally confusing. Do you want to push value? A lot of people in China would support you. Or you now, it's basically from Trump to a lot of military people, to a lot of the policy wonks talking about basically rivalry. We want to bring you down. If the U.S. policy is about bringing down China, then now the government, Chinese government is has a very strong hand internally. They just tell people, if you make trouble for me, you bring down the country.
That is a powerful narrative that could prove persuasive indeed. Final question here then, Andy, regarding the economic projections for China. I mean, we discussed a couple of headwinds that are happening in China that would maybe reduce growth. Are we going to see exponential growth as we've been used to seeing? Or is growth ultimately stagnating at the moment?
We talk about headwinds like a demographic, the decline in birth rate, or property market unwinding. These are factors, and property is like a cyclical factor. It can be replaced by something else. The demography will work over time, not in the short term. The tailwind for China's economy is the potential. Chinese per capita income this year is likely to be $12,000 compared to like 60,000 for Americans and over 40 for Japanese and Europeans. Why should Chinese get paid 30% or less? Chinese people are as well educated as Americans or Europeans and work much harder. And their products are internationally priced. Why should the income be so low? So that is related to the inefficiency in the system. And despite all these inefficient policies, the economy has kept growing. Because of this tailwind, the gap between what the Chinese people should earn and what they are earning now. And the gap is kind of a source of profit for businesses, like in multinational companies. So it will manifest in some way. Now is the factor of the world, and later maybe in the form of a consumption growth. So eventually the economy slows down when what you earn is close to what you deserve. When the gap narrows, the economy could get into stagnation. It's like what Japan happened in the 90s and after, because Japanese were making over $40,000 when Chinese were just getting started. When Chinese could work pretty much like Japanese, how could you justify your $40,000 when Chinese were making a couple of $1,000? So there was obviously a huge gravity. China is so big. China is gravity. And there's nobody else pulling China down. You look at India. India has inflation. That means that it's not really a competitive economy. It's not a structure to compete internationally. So I think there will be growth despite all the policies we worry about. And I think a 5% growth is quite likely despite the headwind from the property market.
All right, Andy, thank you so much for speaking with me today. There's been a lot of insightful perspectives there. I appreciate your time and generosity and thought. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking to Andy Xie, an independent economist based in Shanghai. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.